Glad to see everybody. Hope everybody had a good interim. I would like to start by introducing a few new staff members. New committee administrator, Donovan Hurd, back. And my new LA sitting next to me, Diane Patnode. She's not new to the Senate, but new to the tax committee. So we're very happy that Diane has joined us. And then there's a new DFL committee analyst that was here at the end of session, but I don't think he was real active with some of the committee members, Steve Peterson. And our page this year is Ben, and he's off making copies, but he's a tall drink of water, so you'll recognize him.
Thank you.
And the rest of the staff is the same, and Senator Rest in her meeting tomorrow will introduce her staff. So. We will go on from that. So this morning we're going to hear a couple of reports and a review that the department has done, maybe starting a little slower than the House Tax Committee, but these are important issues that are good for us to move forward on. So we will start with the Iron Range Fiscal Disparity Study and Mr. Ouellette, Department of Revenue. Welcome, Eric. Welcome, Mr. Ouellette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Eric Ouellette, Property Tax Research Director with the Department of Revenue. The Iron Range Fiscal Disparity Study was required in last year's tax bill, and the legislation asked us to take a look at trends in the fiscal disparities program in the taconite relief area, as well as whether there looking for any issues of unpredictability or volatility, and some other things that I will walk through. I'll start just with an overview of the findings so you can kind of get the highlights right away. The fiscal disparities program, the pool of tax base that's shared, has grown significantly in recent years due to strong growth in commercial, industrial, and utility tax base. So the program's a lot larger. The program started in 1995, so it's relatively young compared to its companion program in the metro area, but it has grown significantly in the last 10 years. Jurisdictions in St. Louis County are the greatest net recipients of tax base out of the fiscal disparities pool. They receive more tax base out of the pool than they contribute into it. Conversely, Itasca County is a larger net contributor into the pool. There's $13 million in property taxes that go through the fiscal disparities pool in 2013. To put that into context with some of the other revenue sharing that goes on in the relief area, there's about $78 million of taconite production tax revenues that are distributed through various means around the area, including aid to local governments, credits on the homestead property tax statements, and IRRRB-administered grants and loans to communities. One of the issues that we did explore when looking at the program has to do with a structural issue with the program using previous year's data for some of the calculations, and that can cause some unpredictability in the outcomes of the program, and I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail in a bit. The other major thing that we noticed was the homestead market value exclusion that was enacted in 2011 and took effect in 2012, replacing the homestead credit, had a pretty big impact on the relative tax base of communities around the area, and so it redistributed how the pool is distributed out to local governments because some jurisdictions lost more tax base than others did as a result of the exclusion. And the exclusion had some other impacts as well that I'll discuss in a minute. So those are the highlights.
So, Mr. Ouellette, are you going to get to discussing about who was impacted by that the exclusion change?
Yep. All those highlights I'll go into more detail now.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. So just to remind people how the program works, fiscal disparities is a system for sharing a portion of commercial, industrial, and utility property tax base among the jurisdictions of a region. The taconite relief area and the seven county metropolitan area are the two areas that have a fiscal disparities program. There's a lot of goals or reasons why people say the program
Just a second. Senator Rood, would you like to join us up at the table?
I would be delighted. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, there's often many goals ascribed to the program. Most of them fall under one of three broad goals: support for a regional approach to development, the idea that because a lot of big development happens because of regional investments like transportation infrastructure, or in the case of the range, maybe some investment by the IRRB, the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, that a partial sharing of the outcomes, the tax base that results from that investment may be appropriate. Another goal is equalization of local resources. The program has the effect of taking more tax base away from communities that have more tax base and giving more tax base to those that have less. So it has a bit of an equalizing factor in terms of the tax base of all the communities around the area. And finally, one goal that is often discussed is reducing competition for commercial industrial development. The idea is if every community in the area will get a portion of new commercial development, then they may not work so hard to try and compete with other jurisdictions to get a particular development to happen in their community. Real broad terms, how the program works. It's kind of a detailed, complicated program, but in very broad terms, so property tax base is shared among communities. Every community contributes into the pool 40% of the growth in their commercial, industrial, and utility tax base since 1995. So if a community hasn't had any commercial, industrial, utility growth since 1995, they contribute no tax base into the program. If a community had none before 1995 and now has a lot, they will contribute 40% of what they have in commercial, industrial, and utility tax base into the program. That pool is then distributed out to all the communities in the area based on their relative overall tax base per capita. So if a community is below average tax base per capita, they will get more tax base out of the pool. Conversely, those that are above average will get less out of the pool. And so the proceeds from the pool that go to the community pay a portion then of the levies that are set at the local level by the city, the county, the school district, and any special taxing districts. And so that's from the jurisdiction's perspective. Then they set a levy, and then a portion of it is paid by their local taxpayers, and a portion is paid by the tax base they get out of the fiscal disparities pool. And then from the taxpayer's perspective, if you are a commercial, industrial, or utility taxpayer, when you get your tax bill, you'll have a line for your city, your county, your school, your special district, and then you'll also have a line for the fiscal disparities program. So a portion of your tax is based on that area-wide, the area-wide rate for the program. Real quickly, here's a map of the fiscal, the taconite assistance area. This is the Arrowhead region of northeast Minnesota, and it is not all contiguous, but it is the borders are set by the school districts that meet the statutory definition of having had or continuing to have taconite or mining-related facilities in the school district. As I mentioned at the outset, there's been strong tax base growth in the area. Since 2001, the overall net tax capacity, which is the way we measure tax base for property tax purposes, has grown 80% across the area compared to 42% statewide. So tax base over that time period in this area grew twice as fast as the state average. Much of that growth was in cabin or seasonal recreational residential property. In more recent years, since the recession hit, most of the growth has been in public utility and commercial industrial value. This chart shows the blue bars are by year since 2001, the local tax base, and the red bars are the share of the tax base that goes into the fiscal disparities pool. As of 2013, less than 4% of the area tax base goes into the pool. And as you can see, the overall tax base peaked in 2010 and then has moderated somewhat since the recession hit. In 2001, 4%.
Mr. Ouellette, back to that last graph. Mm-hmm. So the growth in the CI since 1995 is less than 4% of the area tax base. Is that what that graph says?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Yep.
Thank you.
No, 40%. Yeah, the red bar represents 4% of the total tax base, which is the 40% of the growth in the commercial industrial since 95.
40% of the growth.
Yep. Remember, the program started in 1995. In 2001, it was still a very small program because there hadn't been a whole lot of growth between 95 and 2001 in commercial industrial utility property. So as of 2001, about 4% of business tax base went into the pool. That's now up to 22%. As with the metro area program, it will slowly grow towards 40% since that's the maximum contribution a community can make. But there's still all the value, pre-1995 value, that is not contributed. So we'll never get fully to 40% under the way the program's currently structured. The total tax base, but 1% went into the pool in 2001. That's up to 1.7% now. So that red bar was 1.7% of the total tax base. I mean, it's 3.7% of the total tax base now. But it's important to remember that even the communities that are very big contributors to the pool also get some tax base back. So not all that 3.7% of tax base is redistributed. A lot of the communities get a portion of what they contributed right back to them out of the pool. So the amount of redistribution is actually about 1.7% of the total tax base. This is small type, and I apologize, but this is in the tables in the full report, just showing that while the overall numbers are relatively modest, there are communities that have a much bigger impact than that. The table on the left shows the communities, the jurisdictions that have the largest overall reduction in tax base because of contribution to the pool. And the table on the right shows those that see the largest increase in their overall tax base because of the pool. On the left-hand side, you'll see a lot of townships, and many of those are townships that have a pipeline going through them that is new since 1995. So there's a lot of new commercial or new utility value in those townships, and not a lot of other value, not a lot of population, so they don't get a lot of tax base back out of the pool. So those are the ones that lose a higher percent of their tax base because of the pool. On the right-hand side are a lot of the older St. Louis County cities that were significantly impacted by the 2011 enacted market value exclusion, and I'll describe that in a little more detail in a minute. I mentioned that one of the goals often ascribed to the program is reducing tax base differentials or equalizing tax base. What this shows is that the largest net contributors, with Grand Rapids excepted, had on average after the application of the program in 2013 $1,500 of tax capacity per capita, whereas the top 20 recipients from the pool, even after the receiving tax base out of the pool, have an average of $376 per capita. And the column on the right shows what that would have been if the program didn't exist. So you see the gap does narrow some because of the program between the largest contributors and the largest recipients, but there's still a very big gap in the amount of tax base that they have available. And I should note, we excluded Grand Rapids from this table because Grand Rapids had such a larger population than all the other top 20 contributors that it really kind of moved the average quite a bit. Grand Rapids itself is actually below the area-wide average for tax base per capita, but they are a very large contributor to the program because they've had a lot of commercial industrial utility growth since 1995. One of the phenomenons that's important to understand about fiscal disparities is that the area-wide rate, so tax base that's contributed to the pool pays a uniform area-wide rate no matter what jurisdiction it's in, and that area-wide rate tends to be higher than the local rates in a lot of the places where the contribution tax base is coming from. So this shows by year what the area-wide fiscal disparities rate is in the middle, and on the left, or yeah, on the left-hand side, it shows the tax base they would have paid on average if they would have been taxed at the local rate. So the gap is generally between 15% and 25%, and it spiked in 2013 because there was a temporary spike in the area-wide rate, where contributors were on average paying a tax rate 47% higher on the portion of their tax base that goes into the pool compared to what they would have paid if they paid at the local rate. So that's kind of the premium they paid for having their tax base going into the pool. So this chart just shows kind of overall what is the impact of the program in terms of by property type. So this is like a model run that you would see for a tax proposal. So this shows the distribution of net taxes across the entire area with and without the program. And generally what it shows is that business property pays about, on average, 4.3% more in taxes than they would if the program went away, assuming all levies stayed the same without the program in place. Whereas residential homesteads pay about 3% less in taxes because of the program. So overall, the program has the effect of shifting some tax away from residential property onto business property. We were asked as part of the legislative charge to look at how the fiscal disparities program relates to other revenue sources. This table shows this compares the impact of the fiscal disparities to the impacts of the taconite production tax revenues that are distributed through various means. And what the table shows is that when you look at fiscal disparities in isolation, which are the blue and red columns that are right next to each other, you see that Itasca County is the largest net contributor and St. Louis County is the largest net recipient, with the other counties being somewhat in the middle. But when you look at the taconite production tax revenues, most of those revenues are coming from St. Louis County, and the bulk of them go back to St. Louis County, but they are distributed throughout the range. So if you look at the combined redistribution of all those revenue sources, then you see a more even picture. excuse me. And the numbers don't quite add up because there's some of the taconite production tax dollars go to things that can't really be ascribed to individual jurisdictions. So there's a lot of there's the admin dollars and there's grants that are for studies and companies and things like that we didn't assign to a particular jurisdiction. I'd like to talk real briefly about the 2011 market value homestead exclusion. You may remember this was a replacement for the market value credit that was enacted in 2011 and took effect for 2012. And this had a couple of effects on the fiscal disparities program. As I mentioned on the outset, the exclusion basically took a lot of residential homestead residential property value off the tax rolls, so it excluded value from the tax base. And because the pool distributes dollars out based on your tax base per capita, it had the effect of sort of reshuffling where the tax base was distributed out of the program because some jurisdictions lost a lot more tax base than others did. This chart shows some sample jurisdictions. Column one shows what their share of their total tax base is in homestead property. Column 2 shows their change in tax base between 2011 and 2012, which is mostly the effect of the market value exclusion. And column 3 shows the resulting change in their fiscal disparities tax base from 2012 to 2013, because it took a year for it to flow through into the fiscal disparities program. And you'll see Morse Township, which has only 34% of its tax base in homestead property, only lost 1% of its tax base between 2011 and 2012 and had a very modest increase in fiscal disparities distribution in 2013. At the other extreme, you have Chisholm, which has 70% of its tax base in residential homestead property, and they lost almost 30% of their tax base between 2011 and 2013. They saw a 50% increase in their fiscal disparities distribution in 2013. And the other example cities are jurisdictions are kind of in between those two extremes. So the exclusion had this impact of reshuffling where the pool went, and I think that's got a lot of people's attention because they may not have anticipated that impact from the exclusion.
And Mr. Ouellette, oh, you're getting to the leg. Oh,
yep.
Just wait.
Okay. And I should say before I get to the leg, one other impact the Market Valley exclusion had was that because it reduced tax bases, and it especially reduced tax bases in the communities that receive a lot of tax base out of the pool, it had the impact of pushing up the area-wide rate. That because the area-wide rate is based on the tax bases of the communities that receive the tax base. They get the tax base, and they get to use their local rate to tax that tax base. And the area rate is kind of an average of all those once they're all computed. So because Chisholm and other communities already had high tax rates, but they got even higher when they lost all this tax base, that pushed the area-wide rate up. So a business taxpayer in Morris Township, their local rate may not have changed much, but because the area-wide rate went up, the portion of their tax that's at the area-wide rate would have increased significantly. There's a structural issue that has been discussed in the past in the context of the Metropolitan program, and that is that a few of the calculations in the fiscal disparities are based on previous year data, and that's done just because of the complexity in the administration and needing enough time to do all the calculations that they have to use previous year's data for some of the calculations. One of the things that uses previous year's data is the contribution amount. How much of the jurisdiction's tax base goes into the pool is based on their previous year's commercial industrial growth amount. And that has the impact of having a one-year delay in when new commercial industrial tax base goes into the pool. An example on the slide is Wawena Township, which had very little growth in commercial industrial tax base, so it actually was not a contributor at all from 2004 to 2009. But then you'll see in 2012 they had a very large increase in overall tax base. That was when the pipeline that goes through Wawena either was laid down or expanded, I forget which, but they had a very large new increase in utility value. But because the 2012 contribution was based on the previous year's amount of commercial industrial, their their contribution value, the red bar, was quite small. But then the following year, their contribution to the program was based on all this new utility value, so their contribution went up significantly. So this had the impact of giving them basically the entire benefit of the expansion for 1 year, and then their contribution to the pool increased, and they lost a 40% of that tax base in the second year. So it has kind of a one-year blip in the amount of tax base that is contributed for a community, and then it goes back down as the contribution amount is adjusted to reflect that new tax base. As I said, this has been discussed in the past and has been noticed with the Metropolitan Program in the past, and there has been a study done by Anoka County that administers the Metro Program about the feasibility of eliminating the lags. And at the time they wrote the study a few years ago, they thought that it was just not possible administratively to eliminate this because of the need for time to do all the calculations. That may be something that we want to explore again at some time to see if there's now that capability or there may be that capability in the future. But at least as of a couple of years ago, Anoka County thought that they couldn't eliminate this lag. And I haven't talked to St. Louis County specifically about this, but I would assume that they would have the same issues Anoka County would.
Mr. Ouellette, would there be a possibility of eliminating it on the Iron Range because it's quite a bit smaller and they would have a lot less parcels that they're dealing with, or is that not a factor that we could be thinking about?
Mr. Chair and members, that's a good question. I can't answer that for St. Louis County, but I would observe that most of the calculations are done with community-wide total data rather than parcel-level data. I'm not sure if fewer parcels would significantly ease the burden, but I can explore that with both the counties.
Mr. Ouellette, to the lag, was the elimination of the or the implementation of the value exclusion, did that also have a lag issue in that you would have had the value exclusion for 1 year and then it would have had an impact reduction on the next year, or is that not the case?
Mr. Chair and members, the value exclusion impacted the distribution, not the contribution. The contribution is solely based on commercial industrial utility value, but it did have a lag in when it impacted the distributions. So it had that impact, but once there was that 1 year impact, and then everyone kind of stayed where they were at, except for other changes in the tax base that were happening from year to year.
Thank you.
We also did some time thinking about not just what is the experience of the local governments with the fiscal superiority program, but what is the view from the taxpayers' perspective. And one of the things that we observed was there can be a kind of a surprise impact on taxpayers, especially when their community's contribution value jumps significantly. This is an example of Sago Township, which is another one of those townships where the pipeline goes through. And from 2002 to 2010, they were not contributors to the program, so the business property in Sago Township would have been taxed entirely at the local rate. Once there's that new utility property, they are now have a growth since 95, so they contribute commercial industrial tax base into the pool. And the contribution isn't based on my parcel's growth, so it's not just the utility that's a contributor now, it's all the commercial industrial utility property in Sago Township that becomes a contributor when the entire township becomes a contributor township. So,
But when you look at that graph, if you were to look at an individual taxpayer's tax, because the utility came through and only 40% of the growth goes into the fiscal disparity, the overall tax probably went down.
Mr. Chair,
you're getting there?
Yep, I'm getting there. Okay. So here's that same example. So in 2011, the area-wide rate was 138%, and Sago Township's local rate was 75%. Because their contribution share was zero, the effective tax rate for the business taxpayers was the local rate of 75%. In 2013, the area-wide rate jumped to 169%. The local rate was 80%. So the local rate actually went up, even though there was all this new utility value. The contribution share is now 19% because that growth was a pretty significant share of the commercial industrial utility value in the township. So the business taxpayer's effective rate, because they pay 19% of their tax at the area-wide rate and 81% at the local rate, their effective rate was 96% for their overall tax. So if I own a gas station in Sago, and in 2011 I paid my 75% tax rate, 2013 I paid 96% tax rate, even if my value didn't change, that's a 20% increase in the tax. So they didn't have the drop in the local rate that you might have expected from the expansion. But this is just one anecdotal example. Generally speaking, that probably would be the case, that when the tax base expands, the local rate drops, so there's some relief there.
That is really interesting, that they had all that growth in utility, and they still didn't see a reduction in the individual business tax rate. And 40% of it goes into the pool?
40% of the growth goes into the pool, so 60% of the utility value would have been in the local tax.
So I don't understand why the 60% doesn't offset the contribution.
Mr. Chair, this is the danger of using specific examples in a PowerPoint, because I don't know what was going on in Sago that may have affected their decisions. One more note on the view from the taxpayer's perspective. I mentioned in the outset that when a business taxpayer gets their tax statement, this is an example tax statement from St. Louis County. They see their county tax is aligned, their city or town tax is aligned, the state general tax is aligned, the school district, the special taxing districts, if they're in a TIF, that has a line. And then there's this fiscal disparities line all by itself. And I've talked to a lot of business taxpayers and associations representing businesses about this issue, and they hear from their members a lot that The business taxpayers often assume that if the fiscal disparities program went away, their tax would be reduced by whatever amount is on that line. Whereas the way fiscal disparities works is if the program were eliminated, that tax base that's being taxed at the area-wide rate would be redistributed back to their county, their city, their school. So it may be that their tax would go down if their local rate is lower than the area-wide rate, but some communities the local rate is higher than the area-wide rate. So the elimination of the program might actually reduce taxes for some business property. But it would, on the whole, as the model run showed, it would reduce business property about 4.3%. But there's kind of a transparency or accountability issue here about, are the taxpayers getting enough information to know what this fiscal disparities line on the tax form means?
And Mr. Ouellette, we've had some conversations about this example, and maybe something to think about for the committee and for you. If there was a line underneath that that said property, you get 80 cents on your fiscal disparity dollar back. Some jurisdictions will get 80 cents back. Some will get 75. Some will get 110. But that would be informative so that the taxpayer would know that of their $961, they're getting 850 of it back in impact on these other taxes.
Right.
So maybe there's some way we could be a little more informative there.
Mr. Chair, that's a good thing to have a conversation about. Thanks. Finally, just to kind of wrap up, some policy issues that we discussed that are worth chewing on. This program was created in 1995 and modeled after the Metro program that was created in 1971, and all the factors were basically just taken from the Metro program, that the contribution percentage is 40% of the growth from the base year, that the growth before the base year is not included in the fiscal disparities pool, that it's commercial, industrial, and utility properties specifically that are included in the pool. They may be just as appropriate factors for the relief area as they are for the metro area, but whether this is the right amount, the right kind of property, the right amount of redistribution is an issue that I think people always have different opinions about and may be worth having a conversation about. There are times when the local and the area-wide rate differentials are so large that there is that really big tax premium for contributing to the pool compared to the local rate. And I think this is a larger issue in the taconite relief area than it is in the metro area, because there are a lot of very rural townships in the relief area and a lot of very property poor cities that have very high tax rates. So the standard deviation or the spread of tax rates on the taconite area is larger than in the metro area. There are extremes in the metro area as well, but it's a little bit more homogeneous or uniform in the metro area. So that differential is generally but not always bigger. They fluctuate from year to year, but it's generally bigger on the Iron Range. And finally, those transparency issues that we discussed might be worth having a conversation about. There's a lot more detail in the report, a lot of tables and charts, which always makes us researchers happy. So if you have any questions on any of the other material, I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Watt. First of all, just so I'm clear, this was modeled on the metro fiscal disparities, but you can make changes to the one and it doesn't impact the other. There's no correlation.
Mr. Chair, they are separate chapters in the statute, so there's nothing in statute tying them together. It's just that it was modeled after the metro one.
And the other thing your study does highlight is that in this fiscal disparities area, there are other transfers going on, like the production tax, et cetera, that aren't occurring in the metropolitan area.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Questions? Senator.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You mentioned several instances of where the pipeline made a huge difference in the taxes. In Sago Township, a 20% increase. And I know that's just a snapshot in time. My concern is that I have a pipeline project that goes the whole width of Aiken County, and many of the townships are like Sago Township. And so do you expect that type of huge increase for those areas too? Because that's a big concern as sandpiper comes across the whole county. And I would believe that many of the townships would be very atypical of Sago Township.
Mr.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rood, you would expect a similar phenomenon, but let me make sure I'm clear. The 20% reduction is a reduction compared to what their tax base would have been without the program. When the pipeline comes through, the townships will get to keep 60% of the new value, and 40% will go into the pool. So it's not a reduction in their tax base from where they're at today. It's just they'll get less of an increase because of the program. Because 40% of that new pipeline value will go into the pool, and they will get some of that distributed back to them out of the pool. But like the example of Sago and Wawena Township, their tax base is less than it would be if the program went away.
Thank you.
And Mr. Ouellette, just so I can follow up on Senator Rood's question, because I was interested in the impact on Sago, you would have to look at those individual jurisdictions and see what was going on that would cause that, because, I mean, if there aren't anything else going on, the 60% should be larger than the 40%, and they should be seeing some benefit.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I think, Senator Rood, we'd have to go along, and I'm familiar with the sandpiper because it's going through my district also, and I don't have this issue, but we should be paying attention to what's happening in those townships that the line is going through, that they get the benefit. And one of the points that I always try to make to you, my colleagues, and to people interested in these things is part of the reason that these landowners are willing to put up with the inconvenience of having these transmission lines across their property is that they are contributing to the base of the property tax for their schools and counties and et cetera. And if it's not adding up to enough to make up for the inconvenience of having the pipeline go across their land, then there's opposition. And so I appreciate your questions on this, especially with that regard. Anything else, members? Seeing none? Thank you very much, Mr. Ouellette. That was very good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Ms. Fish, we are going to move to the report and study on business production property. This is the distillation tank issue that we have been wrestling with for a year now. And welcome to the committee, Ms. Fish. Could you introduce yourselves for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Klockseem. I'm the Assistant Director for Property Tax with the Department of Revenue. I was also the project manager for this study. First and foremost, I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to present today. I would also like to thank the senators that helped with this study and joined in our tours and discussions. Senator Skoy, Senator Rest, and Senator Newman were active participants. We would also like to thank all those in the industry, as well as the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers, who came and participated and provided their unique knowledge, expertise, and feedback. We conducted four tours of facilities, and we would like to acknowledge Summit Brewing Company, First Association District Dairy, Heartland Corn Products, and Surly Brewing Company, who were kind enough to allow us into their facilities and examine their equipment and their properties and ask some questions about their components. With that, I'll turn this over to Andrea Fish, and she'll walk us through the report.
Thank you. Ms. Fish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrea Fish, and I'm also here today with the Property Tax Division of the Department of Revenue. What we're discussing today with business and production property has been discussed many times over the years. In fact, dating back to the 1960s and early 1970s, there was a tax on equipment. There was a personal property tax. So even at that time, there was a need to define which items would be considered personal property or real property at the various production facilities in Minnesota. Given that, statute and case law have changed many times over the years. Of course, we don't tax that personal property anymore, and we were required to continue to redefine what we felt that meant. The current law defining business equipment as personal property, in fact, predates the first ethanol facility. The language that we have was enacted in 1985, while the first ethanol facility was built in 1988. The current language says that if a piece of property is equipment, but it provides structural insulation or temperature control functions, or if it provides protection from the elements, that part of equipment is considered real property for property tax purposes. While this has its roots in case law, this has been, in fact, codified since 1985. We refer to this as the shelter test. The shelter test was recently upheld in the Southern Minnesota Beet Sugar Co-op v. County of Renville case. In this case, the court found that tanks, bins, and silos that provided walls, a roof or ceiling, and floors did in fact provide a shelter function. And so at this biofuel facility, the shelter function was determined to make those parts of the property taxable real estate. Of course, this did cause specific concerns for the biofuels industry, and the biofuels industry began discussing these issues with the Department of Revenue in 2012, and we continue those discussions with legislature in 2013. Ultimately, legislature decided, of course, last year that it would be prudent to study these facilities and particularly affected industries of biofuels, wine, beer, distilled beverages, and dairy products industries. In order to identify the components used in the processing at each of these cases, and additionally to report our findings to you, and that's why we are here today. This study primarily involved many meetings and discussions with industry professionals, including the affected processing industries and the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. We had meetings and discussions not only as a group, but as well as every tour we had, we discussed what we saw in terms of components at each of the facilities. We toured ethanol facilities, two beer breweries, and a milk processing facility. Additionally, we surveyed assessors on their practices for identifying which components they would consider real property versus those they would consider personal property. We also asked them to identify the contributory value of those components so that we could come up with revenue estimates in terms of the impact that any tax law change would have. After all of the discussions and meetings and tours and all of the information gathering, the Department of Revenue identified three logical approaches to taxation or exemption of business production property. Each is discussed in the report, and we do have revenue impacts for each scenario discussed in the report.
So, Ms. Fish, you talked about the survey you sent out to assessors. How many kind of different mechanisms were being used with regard to these situations across the state? I mean, were there just down to a couple, or were there five, or how much variation did we have?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. What we found in the survey was that assessors were primarily using the shelter test that had been codified and had been upheld by case law. However, to determine whether something provided shelter or not, we were receiving different answers in some cases. Some assessors feeling differently if the component had met a certain size criteria, for example. I believe that we also have members of the assessment community here today who can provide further insight on that.
Okay, thank you.
The first scenario that the Department of Revenue identified is found on page 19 of the report. This recommendation is to revise statutes to clarify when a component used in one of the industries would be subject to property taxes or exempt. Specifically, this recommendation is that components primarily used for processing would be exempt as personal property equipment, while those components primarily used for storage would be considered taxable. This was ultimately the recommended scenario, and I'll discuss it a little further later today. The second scenario we identified is discussed on page 22 of the report, and this recommendation would be to revise statutes so that the definition of taxable real property includes everything attached to or installed in real property. This is very fairly basic assessment procedures where something that is not readily movable from a property without damage to that item or the property itself is typically considered real property. Finally, the third scenario we discussed was not changing statutes, but continuing to enforce current law based on existing statutes and court interpretations. We call this status quo, keeping the status quo for that one. In the appendix of your report, starting on page 53, we do have examples of how each of these scenarios would affect the facilities that we had toured. I'll briefly go over an ethanol facility today and take a look at some components and how they would be addressed under each scenario. Given an ethanol fermentation tank, under scenario one, where anything used primarily for processing would be exempt, this fermentation tank would be considered exempt. Scenario two, however, which states that something that is not readily movable from the property would be real property, would make the fermentation tank taxable. Under current law, which we discuss as scenario three, this is also considered taxable based on the shelter functions that it provides. An ethanol corn storage and a mill under scenario one, the storage.
Ms. Fish, back to the last scenario, and I was on the tour when we were at the ethanol plant, and I don't know, are you going to get to the scenario where they had this type of facility inside a building and outside kind of to the building? I wonder if we shouldn't address that issue to the committee, because what we had was a situation where one of the tanks was outside and therefore would have been taxable because of the shelter test. Another tank providing exactly the same part of the process was inside the building and therefore wouldn't have been subject to the shelter test. So it got to be, where do you draw those lines, being that both tank is doing exactly the same thing? And I don't know if you're planning on getting there, but I recall that that was part of the conversation that we were struggling with.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. I have heard those conversations and I'm familiar with them. While we don't have examples of that for the ethanol facilities within the report, we do have examples of fermentation tanks at the beer processors that are on the interior. And what we found for purposes of our report was that under scenario one, those on the interior, there would still be exempt because they would be primarily used for processing. However, under both scenarios two and three, we found that those would be taxable, meaning under current law, those very large fermentation tanks that are indoors would be considered taxable. But then again, that does come into the subjectivity of determining what the shelter function is.
And then, because that leads me to the next issue, so at that point, you pretty much had decided that size was not a factor, but function was the determining factor.
Mr. Chair, that was what the final recommendation was to identify the function as determining whether something is taxable or exempt.
Thank you.
Moving on to the ethanol corn storage and the mill at the ethanol facility, under scenario one, the storage would be taxable because it's primarily used for storage, while the mill, as part of the processing of corn into ethanol, would be exempt. Under scenario two, both items would be taxable based on the fact that they're not readily movable from the property. And under current law, we did determine that both would also be considered taxable based on the shelter that they provide to those components. For ethanol corn storage and ammonia storage, under scenario one, they would both be taxable as they are both primarily storage. Under scenario two, they are both taxable as they are intended to be permanent accessions to the real estate. They're not readily movable. And under scenario three, current law, we also found that they were both taxable. So in all cases, we determined that the corn storage and the ammonia tank would be taxable real estate. And finally, the ethanol distillation tanks and tubes, under scenario one, both would be exempt as they are primarily used for processing and making ethanol. Under scenario two, both would be considered taxable as they are not readily movable and considered to be permanent accessions to the real estate. Under current law, we would say that the tanks, because of the shelter function they provide, would be taxable. However, the tubes would be exempt. As we did state, the ultimate recommendation in the report would be to revise the statutes to clarify when a component used in one of the affected industries is subject to property taxes or is exempt. And again, what we had recommended specifically was that those components primarily used for production would be considered exempt personal property equipment, and those components primarily used for storage be considered taxable real estate. Ultimately, we thought that of the three recommendations, scenario one provided the clearest distinction between taxable real property and exempt personal property. There would be less need to go through that subjective shelter function test to try and determine if something did meet that criteria. Additionally, it updates and modernizes the tax code to match changes in these industries. As we stated, our current statutes have been in place since 1985, so they do not take into consideration some of the large ethanol or other biofuel processing that the state of Minnesota is currently engaged in. Finally, production components are necessary to the overall process, which is a key characteristic of business personal property equipment. Ultimately, whichever the ultimate outcome of this report and study is, and whether there is a state law change or not, we will continue to increase our educational efforts. This report gave us a great platform to work with our assessors and the community that we use and that we educate to provide them with the knowledge necessary to have equal assessment laws statewide. So no matter the outcome from this, we do plan on increasing the education that we provide.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know there are members from the assessment community and industries here today.
Did you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, excuse me. Mr. Chair, my name is John Claxine. I know there's members of the assessment community here today and members of the industry who may want to speak on this issue, and we'll answer any questions that you may have related to the report.
Thank you. And in order for you to implement scenario one, do we need legislation?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We would need a statutory change in order to implement either scenario one or scenario two.
And does anybody know, has the drafting been started on some of those proposals?
Mr. Chair, it is my understanding that there may be some ideas floating around out there on how to propose the different scenarios. Yeah.
And then either one of you, one of the questions, concerns I have is that we just started with a list of these biofuels, alcohol beverages, and dairy industries. And I know that was what the issue specifically was about on the tour. But at one point in the conversations, we were thinking about possibly using this for all liquids, trying to be a little broader in our interpretation, because what my concern is, we are going to open this up now with the list to other industries coming to be added to the list. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts about that and where this might be leading with regard to other industries that might be coming forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Part of the recommendation in the report was because we were not able to identify how many other industries could possibly be affected if we changed the statute broadly, we did recommend changing the statute to reflect only the industries that we had the opportunity to study in this case, which is, again, biofuels, beer, wine, distilled beverage, and dairy processing. So one of the recommendations was to keep it limited to those that we were able to identify and discuss and study. The statement that I myself said quite often is we don't know what we don't know, so we don't know how many other processing facilities there might be in the state, what their specific components are, and what they're used for. So there was some hesitancy within the group as a whole to make any changes too broad.
And on that same vein, the corn mill is going to now be exempt. And is that's because it's part of the process of taking the corn from whole kernel to a flour or powder?
Senator Chair, that's an excellent question on what specifically the mill is used for. However, because it is part of the processing of corn into ethanol overall, under Scenario 1, the recommended scenario, that would be considered exempt.
Okay. We might need to visit about some of this.
Understand that?
Yeah. Any other questions, members?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, isn't the question... how many questions are there?
Yeah, Senator Ortman. Nothing? I think we should have a little further conversation on some of these. I appreciate the work. I know that there was a lot of travel, a lot of work gone into this. I think you've made real good progress. Maybe a few things we need to kind of contemplate as we move forward and draft language. Seeing no other questions, thank you both very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hold it. There's a list of testifiers. I'm sorry. Mr. Reeder and Mr. Rudnicki. Let's start with those two. Welcome to the Tax Committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members
you
of the committee.
You can fold that laptop down if it's bothersome.
Mr. Reeder was unable to join us this morning, but Randall Doyle is with us here today.
Mr. Doyle.
He is a producer with the Alcorn Biofuels operation in Claremont, Minnesota.
Welcome. Whoever wants to start.
Well, thank you. My name is Randall Doyle. I'm CEO at Alcorn Clean Fuel in Claremont, Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. On behalf of the Minnesota Biofuels Association and other processing industries in the state of Minnesota that you've heard about this morning, dairy, processing, beer making, wine, distilled spirits, and all of those, I want to thank the Department of Revenue and their staff and yourselves for the study that was undertaken this summer. We found it very refreshing to have people come to our facilities to see what we do and to see how we do it and what we're using to make the process that we do. After those several visits were made, the Department of Revenue presented the resulting study and their recommendations, and we endorse that study wholeheartedly and recommend that you adopt their results. We believe that the adoption of those recommendations will result in a more level playing field across the state of Minnesota for all of our industries and see some of this county-by-county difference and difficulties that we have today. Again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you and look forward to working with you all in the coming weeks as you move forward in this process.
Thank you. Thank you for coming down.
Senator, members of the committee, again, thank you for having us here today. And I, too, want to underscore Mr. Doyle's points. Thank you to you and your staff and the Department of Revenue for doing a very thorough study. And while I know
Would you say your name for the tape? We need it for the record to have your name on the tape, please.
It's Tim Rudnicki, R-U-D-N-I-C-K-I. Executive Director of the Minnesota Biofuels Association.
Thank you, Mr. Rudnicki.
So, again, we thank you, and while there may be questions that we need to work with you to address going forward, we're more than happy to do that, looking forward to doing that. And maybe just one comment about this whole notion of process and process equipment. I think when we look at what came out of the study, and if we were to interpret the recommendation in the study, it goes something like this. It's quite simple. And while we're talking about a variety of industries that are impacted here under the study, I'll just pick on biofuels for a moment. If we know the end result we want to get is 200-proof alcohol that will eventually be used for transportation fuel, one of the simplest tests we have, whether it's for the hammer mill that's used to break the corn into components that can be used to make alcohol, or whether it's a fermentation tank, the test is simply this. If you took that hammer mill out of the process, or if you took a fermentation tank out of the process, could you get the end result, the end product of ethanol, 200 proof? If the answer is yes, you can take the component out and still get that 200 proof. It is real property. On the other hand, if you take that component out and you cannot get that end product, it must be a process component. It is part of the equation to get to the end result. So we're more than happy to work with all of you, again, to answer any detailed questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions, members? Seeing none, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Efritz and Mr. Baker. Not here. Mr. Vanasek, do you have anything to add? Seeing anybody else wish to testify on the report and study on business production property? Seeing none, thank the department. Thank you very much. Assessor accreditation review, Mr. Hagen. Oh, is she here?
She's with the townships.
I had a testifier for the IRRR fiscal disparities report that I skipped. So when we're done with the assessor accreditation review, if Commissioner Marcotti, if she's here, we will have time for her to comment on the IRRRB report. I don't see anybody moving. Okay, Mr. Hagen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to appear before you today. For the record, my name is John Hagen. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Last session, two significant pieces of legislation were passed relating to assessors. Both these changes, in our opinion, will improve the quality of assessment throughout the state of Minnesota. The first clarified that county assessors can file a written complaint with the Commissioner of Revenue in the case of nonfeasance, malfeasance, and misfeasance by a local assessor. The second that I'm here to speak directly about today increased the level of education for some assessors, requiring that every individual who appraises or physically inspects real property for the purposes of determining its valuation or classification for property tax purposes must obtain licensure as an accredited Minnesota assessor by the State Board of Assessors by July 1, 2019, or within 4 years of their first licensure as a certified assessor. If I could just reflect a bit during, you know, whenever significant problems with assessment are encountered, they're usually attributable to one of three potentials. Either the assessor doesn't have sufficient training or education, or two, the assessor knowingly and intentionally is not properly completing the assessment, or three, the assessor simply does not have sufficient staff to conduct the assessment. Last year's legislation addressed two of these three potentials. In my 28 years with the Department of Revenue, I would guess that the majority of legislation that we've dealt with and you've created has been the result of complaints or concerns with assessments. To briefly recap some of the licensure requirements, by December 1, 1974, the legislature required that all assessors become certified Minnesota assessors. A few years later, they required county assessors to become accredited Minnesota assessors by January 1, 1981. And the third step was implemented that by January 1, 1989, all county assessors and regional representatives of the Department of Revenue would have to be senior accredited Minnesota assessors. So there's been a continuing pattern to upgrade the need or the quality of assessment and the designation of assessment as the complexity of the assessments increase over time. There have been a few modifications that the State Board has imposed. For instance, in 2012, they did increase the requirements for certified assessors by adding one additional course from what was required in the original 1974 requirements. However, that course was a course in residential appraisal. However, that course did not apply to any assessors that were certified from during the time of 1974 until it was implemented in 2012. So that whole group did not need that additional education. There's very few professions that have not experienced significant change in how they do their job from during the 70s or 80s or even the 90s. I know I started as an assessor in 1972. And there's almost no semblance to what, or resemblance to what I did in 72 and what I was taught in those early years to how the job and the profession is done now. The world has changed a lot, and we have to stay abreast of those changes. In 2001, the legislature recognized how the assessment requirements were changing and how the complexities were increasing. They completed something that we call a PACE course. It's an educational course put on by the Department of Revenue that requires all assessors, all licensed, accredited, and senior accredited assessors to take that course once every four-year licensing period. Certified assessors don't have to take this. They missed that opportunity. one benefit of requiring all assessors to be accredited by 2019 will mean that all assessors in the state are taking this ongoing presentation and one-week course on new laws and law changes and assessment changes. Another benefit that counties will experience down the road from this increased workforce, there's currently something of a shortage of accredited and senior accredited assessors in the state. Frequently, when a county, particularly an out-of-state county, advertises for a county assessor, and because the offices become vacant, because the assessors moved on, or for whatever reason, they oftentimes have a very, very, very limited pool. Consequently, they end up competing with other counties and in effect, stealing county assessors away from another county, so it gets to be a bidding war to try and move the county assessors around. And a part of this is because oftentimes the only person licensed in that area and in many county area to do the job of county assessor, which is a minimum requirement of being an accredited Minnesota assessor, which in 2 years they have to become senior accredited. There's nobody with that license level around, so they have to go try to get people out of the metro or try to get people from another county. After this is passed, after this legislation is fully implemented, in 2019, all assessors will be accredited and the pool will greatly increase for the number of assessors that are eligible to receive that or to serve as county assessors. In closing, I'd like to acknowledge that certainly there is a cost for education, but there's also a cost and a consequence for not having a properly trained workforce. That concludes my presentation. I'll certainly stand for any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. And from my recollection of the discussions we were having last year as these provisions were moving forward, I kind of viewed this as continuing education for assessors and part of the professional development that these professionals need in order to be good and accurate assessors of properties across Minnesota. I mean, we want consistency. We want Minnesotans in varying jurisdictions being dealt with the same with regard to the values on the property if the properties are similar. And so I think it's, from my perspective, important to have this continuing education for these folks. And, you know, if there is an issue with cost, I would be curious to hear that and what the ramifications of that are. The one thing that I would like you to talk just a little bit more about so people have an understanding is of the, there's a mechanism where the Commissioner of Revenue had some authority within regard to the professional association. Is there something there that the committee needs to understand more fully? Mr. Hagan, can you help me with that?
Mr. Chair, my apologies. I'm not following the question.
Okay, well, didn't we have if there was a complaint against the assessor where they would go to DOR and then the commissioner would recommend to the professional organization a cause of action? Can you walk us through that?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was fixated on education, I guess. But the second part of the last year's legislation provided that it clarified that county assessors or any assessor for that matter could make a complaint about an assessor, a local assessor, or a staff assessor that was based on malfeasance, misfeasance, or nonfeasance. And the commissioner would investigate that charge or those charges of inappropriate behavior, and they would report to the State Board of Assessors. And the State Board of Assessors would have to take the appropriate action to deal with that individual's licensure, and it varies, of course, from I'm sure in some cases they would find there was no basis to the complaints, where some instances might lead to actually removing the licensure of a particular assessor. And the State Board of Assessor, my memory is they are required to report back to the legislature on their activities in a two-year period.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. I appreciate that clarification. Any questions, members? Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Hagan, I noticed you mentioned that once this is fully implemented that there would be a much larger pool of accredited Minnesota assessors, and I can understand the reasoning why you would get to that. But assessors from my part of the state are concerned that it could shrink the overall pool if you include assessors of even, say, a certified Minnesota assessor, that would shrink the pool of assessors overall and create a shortage. And I know that some of the counties out in western Minnesota are having trouble filling positions now. I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kuhn, and that's a legitimate concern. There's a lot of township assessors have, were licensed in the early 70s, and part of the, and they took their training and really haven't had any week-long training or any sustained training other than maintaining their minimum continuing education units, which is a pretty small amount over the years. So they have not had the cost of additional education. A lot of the local assessor workforce is older. I believe, I'm not sure I could put my hands on it, but about 20% of the local assessor workforce is 60 or older. There's some that are 70s, and there's one or two that are eight in their 80s. So that is going to be a concern going forward. I think over time, I think the way assessments are completed will have to change in the state of Minnesota. I see over the long period of time, there's probably going to be a movement away from local assessors as educational requirements and demands on the profession increase. It's not really going to be economically viable for people to have it as a part-time job, just a job that they spend a couple weeks a year doing, or a job that retired individuals do because of the investment in education and the complexity of the subject. I think in time, local assessors have been not disappearing, but they've been diminishing in the number of local assessors quite steadily probably in the last 30 years. And I anticipate that that group will continue to diminish as more and more counties take over the job of assessing and become what's called a true county assessor system, where you have full-time educated professional staff that take it on. But that concern is legitimate. I think initially there will be a loss in some of the local assessors who do not want to continue to get the extra education and continue with the job, so they're quite likely they'll have to hire more staff, and that may well be county staff that is responsible for the whole county and not just a particular jurisdiction.
Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I hear what you're saying, and it's true that some of the local assessors are moving up in age. But just kind of an example of you're talking about moving to a county system of assessors. In Chippewa County, there's been some change on assessor retirement. We had another person move into the position of county assessor, and they put a notice out to hire another person for the staff in the assessor's office. And at the first round, they weren't successful. They did a second round, and still not successful. No applicant that would qualify. They did have a couple that qualified in that process, but once they saw the work or the job description, they backed away from it. Now they're in the third round, and so we'll see where this goes. But even before this is fully implemented, there's some issues with getting assessors. So I just want to make the committee aware of that it is an issue.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. And to the point of the pool of people available to do assessors, I'm looking at Section 8 and 15, where they're authorizing the State Board of Assessors to deal with any other persons employed by an assessment jurisdiction. So are these assessors able to hire people to help them with their assessing that have different levels of qualifications?
Mr. Chair, that opens up quite a debate. Some assessors would advocate that data collectors are not assessing the property and consequently they don't have to be licensed. In your language, Mr. Chair, I was quite clear that this involves people that are involved in physically inspecting or appraising the property. And it's sort of a fine line between data collectors that simply go out and make notations on what a property looks like in the physical condition of the property and assessing the property. And depending on your perspective, you can draw the line or move the line quite a ways to suit your own purposes, I guess, or your own desires. I am very concerned that data collectors would be used on some of the more complex properties. We just heard the discussion on the bins and tanks and the ethanol tank properties, and I can't imagine a data collector without specific educational training and going out and making a determination of what is taxable and what's not taxable. And oftentimes the condition of a property and if there's depreciation or mold or all the other things that are encountered during an assessment that require a certain amount of training. So there, data collectors are a potential. I'm a little concerned about the widespread use of data collectors.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. Anything else? And Mr. Hagan, why don't you move over? We have a couple other folks who would like to talk on this. Mr. Bosch and Mr. Knudsen, Chippewa County Assessor and Swift County Assessor, are they here? Welcome to the committee, and whichever one of you would like to start first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kent Bosch. I'm a local assessor in Chippewa County, and I've heard this discussion, and I've been involved in the discussion with our county assessor for quite a while over this issue. We have a major problem out in the country, and just a little background. In Chippewa County, I do local assessing for two townships, and that encompasses approximately 700 properties. And of those 700 properties, only one of them is a commercial property. And in those cases, in the rural townships, what we do is we have one of the qualified staff on the county staff do that property. Because if you're not familiar with it, commercial properties require a higher certification for assessing, like they're talking, wanting us all to achieve. This is going to cost our local townships a lot of money when this law goes into effect in 2019, because we're going to have a vast shortage of certified people to do the work, so our costs are going to go up. They're going to be able to charge whatever they want. Right now, I don't get paid a lot to do these assessments. I'm doing it more as a local, call it community service, whatever you want. I live in the township that I assess, and I do that to keep our costs down. As far as the training that's being required, the main thing that I see in the 4 or 5 weeks of additional training that I would be required to take to get my certification up to the level where I could assess after 2019 has a lot to do with commercial properties and income approach appraisals. I don't need that kind of education to do the kind of assessing that I've been doing and that I believe will continue to be done in the rural areas in Minnesota. Virtually all of our assessing has to do with sales studies and that type of assessment, not income approach assessment. If you bear with me, I'm not a public speaker. I'm going to look at my notes here a little bit. But the staff from the Department of Revenue talked about the complexity of our assessing and how it's changing. I haven't seen any changes. I've been assessing for only 5 years, so I'm not one of these people that got trained in 1970 and continues to assess as a income supplement or retirement account or whatever you want to call it. It just seems to me like this is something that the Department of Revenue came up with for job security so they can continue to put on these education classes. And a little bit, maybe there has been some malfeasance and some other feasance brothers going on out in the country. I don't know. But that has nothing to do with education level. That has to do with ethics. And we're all required every 4 years to take an ethics course. So I think we're covered there. We also are required every 4 years to do continuing education for a week. And it's not cheap. They charge the going rate for the University of Minnesota and for the Department of Revenue to come out and give these classes. I also want to say that I'm here as a citizen of the state of Minnesota on my own time and my own dollar. I didn't get paid to drive 130 miles of bad roads today and go home in a blizzard. A lot of the people that are in this room are being paid to be here, including all of the Department of Revenue staff. So I hope you take my comments to heart and just do what's right for the state of Minnesota. I think this law just kind of got passed through without a lot of people realizing what was going on. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments. But let me assure you that this is not a department initiative. It's an initiative of mine. And I drug them to this result.
I can appreciate that.
That they didn't want to do this. I forced it on them. Mr. Knutson.
My name is Wayne Knutson. I'm the Swift County Assessor, and I'd like to thank Senator Conan for inviting us here and the committee, and especially Mr. or Chairman Scully for allowing us to voice our opinion. I have a brief disclaimer. My opinion is my opinion only. I'm not here representing anybody but our office. And our office in Swift County deals with about 10,000 parcels. We're not a huge county. We have three full-time staff in the office. We are responsible for about 4,000 parcels directly out of the county office. The remaining 6,000 parcels are the responsibility of our local assessors. We currently have seven local assessors that are providing the services for those 21 townships. Of those seven, one has indicated that he will continue to and wants to continue to further his accreditation and continue serving those townships. That leaves, and currently he's assessing for eight townships. That leaves 13 townships unaccounted for. We do not, I am not aware of a pool to choose from for our local townships or county staff. If the county has to take over the responsibility for those 13 townships, we will have to hire staff. We have been in discussion with our administrator and our county commissioners because we were looking at a 2016 deadline for a while. 2019 is a little more, gives us a little more time, but our administrator was starting to panic. They want to know where they're going to get money and how much it's going to cost to get somebody on board. Those numbers, I've put together numbers of my own. I don't know that they mean a whole lot, but for us to hire somebody off the street and get them to AMA within 4 or 6 years, it's going to be a considerable amount to the county besides the salary. Currently, I'd ballpark one employee at probably 40 to 50,000 cost to the county. You add education and time of when they're not being productive in helping with the assessment, when they're being educated and trained, is also a loss to the county and to our office. I did bring two of our local assessors with me today. Dale Erickson has been with the county a number of years. He personally does five townships in Swift, and he also contracts some with Kandi, Ojai, and Chippewa. Dale has indicated he will not continue to further his education. Another one that brought along is David Qualley. David's kind of unique. He has just spent the time and the effort and the money to attain his four courses and to begin the job in the assessment field. Again, supplemental job. But to have to tell him he's not done yet. He just served a year internship under Dale to apply for his certified Minnesota assessor's license. Either scenario or option, I guess, is what our administrator wants me to provide to the township. Our costs, I can't see any way that they're going to do anything but go up. If the county takes over, we're not going to be doing it for what most of our locals are being paid now. It's going to cost, I don't know, 15 to 20%, maybe 25% more for a township. Plus the addition to the county of employees. I'm professing, I guess, I don't think we can get by with one employee in Swift County. I am asking, are going to ask for two. We're already understaffed, and to add more, the complexity of the business is just to do away with the knowledge level and base that a lot of our locals have and attain, to me, is unacceptable, I guess. I cannot and will not deny that education is good. I would support any of our locals and office staff to further their education as far as they can. But when it eliminates and creates these kinds of costs for our office, I got a problem.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And we did have representative from the Assessors Association last year working with us on the timeline. And originally we did have it shorter. I thought that they felt that it was a doable timeline by the 2019 timeline. I would encourage you to work with us and the department to see if there are things that are, you know, where we would have to make adjustments for some reason or another. But I do think it is important. One of the issues that we deal with so often is consistency assessing across the state, and it's really, really important for us to have a consistent assessing practices. So all properties, irrespective of where they are being dealt with comparably. But if there are glitches in what we did that we need to take a look at, be happy to contemplate that and encourage you to work with Senator Coonan or the department or myself, and we'll look at whatever we think we might have.
I have made the statement in an email I believe I sent to Senator Coonan that in respect to poor local assessors or people that aren't doing their job, I'm of the opinion that that's our responsibility, that's the county's responsibility. There are things in place to already address those issues if they need to be addressed. The requirement of the education, is it going to eliminate some of that? I have questions, I guess, about that.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hartman.
Mr. Chair, I appreciated your last comment, Mr. Assessor, because I have to observe that part of the problem with these discrepancies have to be because of the property tax classification system itself and all of the complexities. I mean, if we just keep creating more and more and more property tax classifications, well, these guys are going to have to be in school for half the year. I mean, I think we have to take some ownership over the complexity of this property tax classification system and say there are going to be discrepancies when folks in different areas of the state start applying all these very minute details and all these differentiations and try and come up with the same results. I think we have to own some of that, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure that sending these folks to more education is going to solve what is a very big part of the problem.
Mr. Chairman, may I add comment?
Mr. Bosch.
Just yesterday, it's just coincidental, but just yesterday, every assessor, every certified assessor in the state of Minnesota got an email from the Department of Revenue. And I'm hoping that this committee got that email. If not, I'd like to forward it to Senator Coonan. But the email is very specific about there's a very specific list about what the current accreditation is by township and by county in the state of Minnesota and what it will need to be, of course, in 2019. And the list is so outrageously large that it's not a if you just look at that list, I think you would agree with some of us that are saying it's not realistic what is being required.
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, in response to that, that was not the Department of Revenue that sent the list out. It was the State Board of Assessors. The State Board of Assessors has, since it was in its inception in 1970, been required to develop a licensure list, or at least shortly after their inception. They have been required to develop a licensure list, a minimum licensure list for every jurisdiction in the state.
You're right.
And that is precisely what that list was.
Okay. Thank you. Anything else, members? Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, say, I'd like to thank you for giving the assessors a chance to voice their concerns here. When it comes, well, Mr. Knutson mentioned some of the extra costs that could be involved here, and I got an email from the assessor in Larkapal County, Lori Schwendeman, and she worked on the costs of the actual courses, and I can make this available for the committee, but what she came up with is for somebody brand new coming off the street, just the cost of the course itself would come up to about $9,400, and that would be for each new assessor. If there's somebody going from a certified Minnesota accountant to an accredited Minnesota accountant, she came up with about $4,300 or $4,400 to make that move. And that's just the cost of the course. That wouldn't include in-house training and all of that type of thing. But again, Mr. Chairman, thank you for, you know, giving the assessors a chance to voice their concerns here. And Mr. Bosch and Mr. Knutson, thanks for coming. And Mr. Erickson and Mr. Qualley in the back there, too. And Mr. Hagan, also thank you for your comments. And I have one final comment. Mr. Hagan, I don't know if I'm going to quoting you exactly right here, but you said there was three issues: was lack of training, for discrepancies in how the job is done, is lack of training, assessors that just aren't doing the job, or not enough staff. And I think what we're hearing a concern here today is the not enough staff part of it. At least out in our part of the state, that's, I think, a pretty big issue, and especially as you look into the future. So, but thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything else? Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask Mr. Hagan, what is the I'm curious about these classes. Who does the person who wants to be an assessor have to fund those classes themselves, or does the county or township fund them? And is there any kind of compensation for attending them or anything like that?
Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chair, Senator Eaton, I think the answer to that is it varies. Certainly county employees are paid for by their employer. Mr. Bosch could perhaps comment too. I think some townships do pay for the training. And I used to be an instructor for a number of years, and a lot of people trying to get into a different profession were paying their own way to get certified just to try to get basically their foot in the door in a new profession. So I think the answer is it really varies. I think I would guess the majority of the cost is borne by governmental entities, but I think there's a lot of individuals that pay their own way as well.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Bosch.
I think he's got a very correct assessment of that. In my case, my township had agreed to pay for my training in the first place. We had an assessor 5 years ago that wanted to quit doing it, and he went around the township recruiting. It took him a long time to talk me into it, but I like learning new things and doing new things. But it is something that, regardless of whether an individual is paying the cost or a township is paying the cost or a county is paying the cost, it's going to cost us all a lot of money.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for traveling to St. Paul. Thank you and we'll stay in touch.
Thank you.
Nothing else. Members, we will be meeting next week on Tuesday and Thursday. There is a list of bills for Tuesday. And Senator Rest, about tomorrow?
9 o'clock.
The division is meeting tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Anything else? Okay. If you have issues you'd like paper you'd like to save, put it in your folder and it will be saved. Otherwise, it's going to get tossed. Thank you very much. Committee's adjourned.